Mark Plotkin is an ethnobotanist and ethnomycologist with 4+ decades working in and on the Amazon jungle. Mark was one of the last students of Richard Evans Schultes, the world-renowned Harvard botanist widely described as the father of modern ethnobotany. That makes Mark a direct inheritor of the tradition his keynote addresses at the 46th annual Telluride Mushroom Festival. At Mushroom Festival, Mark is everywhere you want to be. So again, his keynote is Thursday at the Telluride Conference Center, the title, The History of Hallucinogens at Harvard. Then there are two events on Saturday, Rainforest Conservation and the Search for New Shamanic Medicines. Then a panel discussion, Latest Research from the World of Functional and Medicinal Fungi. Those two Saturday sessions actually give us two sides of Mark's coin, particular coin, actually his worldview, the indigenous knowledge conservation argument in the morning and the Western research conversation in the afternoon. This is Susan Vibrock, Telluride Inside and Out. I'm honored to be speaking once again with Mark Plotkin. Our last conversation dates all the way back to the mid-90s, around the time of the publication of his book, The Shaman's Apprentice. Oh, and by the way, yes, he's an author, and also his podcast, and you can tell me the title, Mark, again. I think it's The Plants of the Gods.
Plants of the Gods.
Indeed. Yep, okay, is entering its 9th season. Regardless, this conversation marks a much overdue update. Hey, Mark, thanks for taking time out of your crazy schedule to join me. So let's cut right to the chase. You've been hard-focused on the commercialization of plant medicines. What worries you most about where the current boom is heading?
Well, Susan, it is good to be back in touch, and as I have done for many decades, I run a not-for-profit, so we don't do any commercial development. We're great believers in the idea of intellectual property rights, a sticky issue, but an important one, and believe that for far too long, indigenous peoples, local peoples, have not received the benefits they should. So we stand at their side in terms of helping them protect their knowledge, which is disappearing much faster than the species themselves, and trying to help them deal with the outside world on their own terms. So the short answer to your question is, to quote Charles Dickens, it's the best of times and the worst of times. The best of times, since we first chatted several decades ago, where very few people were interested in these issues of mind-altering substances. The worst of times is that everybody is interested in these issues.
And right.
To sum it up, I'll quote one of the tech bros who a couple of years ago said, I finally took the magic mushrooms. It was a life-changing experience. I finally now understand Bitcoin.
Thank you. I could end the interview on that note. It was so good. But we're going to move on to my next question, which is, does the psychedelic gold rush help or threaten the conservation mission you've spent 40 years building?
The psychedelic gold rush is tremendously exciting and positive in the sense that because people are interested, this knowledge is not going to disappear. If we get it right, these plants and fungi and frogs won't disappear. But it's tremendously threatening because you have lots of people jumping on the bandwagon. They may have done a weekend workshop at Sedona or Esalen and start thinking that they are shamans. And when they are seen by people who are held together by scotch tape, as Michael Pollan essentially put it, in terms of describing some of these people with issues of emotional problems that haven't been cured or improved by Western medicine, they can come apart. And these pseudo-shamans, neo-shamans, are not well-placed to put those pieces back together.
Thank you for that caveat, Emtor. Your Amazon conservation team is indigenous-led by design. What have you learned about seeding control that you didn't understand back when the organization was co-founded in 1995?
Well, our goal has always been to work ourselves out of a job, and it's to collaborate with, learn from, train, empower Indigenous and Afro-Amazonian colleagues. The good news is much progress is made, and not entirely due to us, that these people are increasingly in touch with the outside world, or increasingly tech savvy, which is very important and usually a positive thing. The bad news is there's some people who think, just give the money to the Indians and get out of the way. And I always reply by noting that there are a fair number of Indigenous peoples in Canada, the U.S., Central and South America, who can read a balance sheet far better than I can, but there are also close to 180 isolated and uncontacted groups of peoples who are in no condition to receive enormous grants and think that this is going to solve their problems.
180, that's astounding. After, when you say uncontacted, that includes by your organization.
Yeah, we are in the fortunate position of having been leaders in the Secretariat overseeing the effort to protect these people. And when I say that we want to protect them, I don't mean that we want to build a fence out and treat this as some sort of human zoo, God forbid. But what we do want to do is keep out the bad guys, the narcos, the fundamentalist missionaries who want to beat Western religion into their heads, the illegal timber barons, and create a world where these people can make their own decisions at their own pace and what they want to do with the outside world, if anything.
Okay, thank you for that. You inherited the so-called Harvard lineage directly through your mentor, Richard Evans Schultes. What is the piece of that history that gets lost or told incorrectly?
Well, people call Schultes the father of ethnobotany, and he points out that the first ethnobotanical expedition was done by a female pharaoh in ancient Egypt, and he's quick to point out he wasn't that old. When Schultes is remembered as the grand old man, which in many ways he was, I think that people fundamentally misunderstand a lot of his cosmo view of this type of things. He often said to me, you know, these indigenous peoples, these so-called primitive peoples who may not have last names, may not know how to write their names if they have them, may not be wearing clothes, know a lot more than you and me. And so Schultes, I see as a trickster in the positive sense. Trickster, of course, archetypal characters that appear in many myths across many cultures.
Right.
But if I had to boil down what a trickster is, I'd say that here he is a boundary crosser. And when you have this esteemed, tenured Harvard professor telling his students that these so-called primitive peoples knew more than he did, that wasn't a common sentiment amongst the Harvard faculty at the time he began to espouse this very correct sentiment.
Thank you for that update then. With antibiotics failing and sort of epidemic possibility diseases spreading and viruses getting smarter, how real is the cause for fungi and rainforest species as the next medical frontier? And I say that guardedly since you've been around the Amazon jungle for over 40 years, but it's becoming the next medical frontier. So your comments on that.
You know, Susan, my first book, Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice, which we discussed when it came out, was very successful. My next book was called Medicine Quest, where I looked at the panoply of medicines from nature and the potential. And when I tried to find a good reference on drug-resistant bacteria and the role and the history of antibiotic development, I couldn't find one, so I decided I'd write it myself. So I found a co-author, and I wrote a book called The Killers Within, The Deadly Rise of Drug-Resistant Bacteria. So for an ethnobotanist, I know this story pretty well. We did predict that there would be a pandemic coming. We did not predict that it would be viral and not bacterial, but we also have to worry about protozoal. The fact of the matter is that humanity has always suffered from the effects of these critters and always will. So we're not going to find the super drug that's going to defeat COVID or drug resistant staph or some of these nasty protozoans We have to keep looking. And so nature has been creating weird and wonderful chemicals for 3 billion years. So I think she's a little more creative than our best chemists and AI, I must add, to keep it topical. And I got an argument with a very esteemed infectious disease physician a few months back where he said, AI will solve this issue. And I vehemently disagreed and said, you're wrong. I said, this issue will be solved or lost by HI. And he said, what's that? And I said, not artificial intelligence, human intelligence. AI is a tool. And like many tools, it can be used for good or it can be used for bad. Even a scalpel, it can heal you, it can hurt you. So what we need is to protect nature's bounty, learn from the indigenous and peasant and local peoples who are willing to teach us, sometimes they're not. And it's not a choice between the microchip and the medicine man. The sweet spot is somewhere in between. And so this whole idea, like we have AI, we don't need to worry about new antibiotics from fungi, is phenomenally stupid. But I have to say the idea that nature, Mother Nature, has all the answers and we don't need AI is equally foolish.
Okay. Well, then, clearly this is a time will tell story, right?
Correct.
What did you get wrong early in your career, or what would you tell your younger self entering the field now?
Well, ethnobotany used to be like, let's go down there, let's get it, let's bring it back, let's see what it's for, and maybe make some money at it. Now, Schultes never taught that this is all about profit. You know, he was the one who encountered magic mushrooms. I won't say discovered. He never used that term. He always said it's the indigenous peoples who discover these things.
But
if you look at the burgeoning market of the sales of psilocybin, magic mushrooms, ayahuasca, all things that he encountered, he never made a nickel from that. And one of the things I'll be talking about in Telluride, and one of the things is a few fun guys and gals don't know, is that beta blockers were developed from the molecular structures of the magic mushroom. And that's a multi-billion dollar business. And Schultes and the ethnobotanists and the Mazatecs who taught us these mushrooms never made a nickel. That's no longer acceptable. That is not the way that this business should be done now or in the future. It is the way business was done in the past. Mm-hmm. But I think that we want to capture some of these monies to protect these forests, to protect these people, to send them to school, whether it's law school or medical school or what have you. And that is a developing paradigm, one that we need to improve and develop rather than figure that, we don't need to give money to these people because they're outside the monetary economy, except for the 180 isolated and uncontacted peoples in South America. Everybody's in the monetary economy to some degree in the American hemisphere.
That's a nice segue to my next question. Again, referring to your book, The Killer Within, that is a medicinal plant handbook. And help me with the name of the tribe for the Trio?
No, the Killers Within is my book on drug-resistant bacteria. The Shaman's Apprentice Handbook is the book of the Trio, the book of the Trio medicines. It's all in their language. It is accompanied by photos. And as far as I know, it's the first book in their language about their culture. The only other book in their language was provided by the missionaries, and that's the Bible. So the Bible doesn't have much to do with caimans and snakes and medicinal plants. So I'd like to think that's of limited utility on a day-to-day basis than this book is in terms of healing.
Right. So, and pardon me for conflating your two different books, but what did it mean to hand a people their own knowledge in written form, and how has that model of reciprocity held up over the decades?
Well, you know, we talked about this last time about the fact that one of the ways that the indigenous peoples agreed to work with me and share this knowledge is that I would return it to them in written form. which I think at the time was more of a novelty than a recognized need.
Mm-hmm.
But once they saw their culture, their knowledge, their forest, their plants, their medicines in written form, accompanied with photos, it was a revelation. Because if you've been taught that Western culture has all the answers, if you've been taught that Western culture and religion and medicine is infinitely superior and has all the answers, it's a revelation at the end of the book that shows that your culture has knowledge, your knowledge has value, and you should not be throwing out your culture or losing your culture or forgetting your culture because a bunch of white guys wearing crosses told you this is something you'll never need.
So has this notion taken root among the cultures you have contacted? And has this model of reciprocity held up?
Well, the answer is a resounding yes, because as I hoped for and even predicted, as soon as one village of indigenous colleagues had this book in their language, that the next village over would say, wait a minute, we can do that. We can do it the same or we can do better. And we were matched. Okay, we've now worked with indigenous groups throughout South America, mostly the Amazon, but not solely, to help people map their own lands. And once again, it wasn't the white man or the white woman or the white scientist going in there and doing it for them. It's saying, okay, essentially, you're driving the car, we'll ride shotgun, we'll read the map and make some suggestions, but it's your work, your job, your car, your culture, your forest.
Okay, thank you for that. And finally, let's get a little personal. Please talk about your origin story and the white light moment that set you on your life path into the jungle, no less.
Well, I don't know how many of your interviewees can answer that very simply and clearly, but I can tie it to September 23rd, 1973, when I walked into a night school classroom at Harvard to take a class on the botany and chemistry of hallucinogenic plants. And the professor, a very solid fellow in a white lab coat and a red Harvard tie, turned off the light and began to work as magic. And the slide that changed my life forever was a picture of three indigenous peoples in the Colombian Amazon dressed in grass skirts and bark cloth masks. And he said, and I quote, "Here you see three Indians of the Yukuna tribe doing the Kayari dance to keep away the forces of darkness. The one on the left has a Harvard degree." Next slide, please. That picture made me fall in love with plants, Indians, and the Amazon.
Wonderful. I think we're going to call that an amen. Thank you, Mark Plotkin. This has been Susan Dubrock. Honored to speaking with Mark once again and again. Mark is everywhere you want to be at the Telluride Mushroom Festival, starting on Thursday evening at the Telluride Conference Center, the subject, the history of hallucinogens at Harvard. Mark, I can't thank you enough for your time.
Thank you, Susan, and I hope it's not another 30 years before we do another interview, and I look forward to connecting in person in a few days.
Yes. Okay. Have a good, I know you'll have a busy, but also have a good day.
Thanks, Steph. See you soon.
See you soon.